This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tick tock, tick tock. Can somebody in Washington make a deal already? Looks like we're heading over the edge of the fiscal cliff, folks. The latest, plus why an unemployed steelworker is glued to the negotiations. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast from Monday, December 31st. Thanks for being here. Here's the latest on the fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington, in three words.
It's not done.
It's not done. That was President Obama earlier today, surrounded by a stage full of apparently middle-class Americans. He was urging Congress, some might say trying to shame Congress, into getting a deal done before midnight tonight that would prevent middle-class tax hikes and automatic spending cuts from kicking in after the new year. Doesn't look like it's going to happen. It appears they were making some progress on taxes, but not on spending cuts. Joining us now are Heidi Moore of The Guardian and Sudeep Reddy of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Heidi, the president was taking some not-so-subtle jabs at Republicans today during that media conference. Take a listen here after he says he would have preferred to have a grand bargain.
But with this Congress, that was obviously a little too much to hope for at this time.
And, of course, that wasn't really the most cutting thing he said, was it, Heidi? Was that helpful, hurtful, strategic on his part, do you think?
It was really hurtful. I mean, afterwards, what happened is it looked like we were really close to a deal. And then after that, Senator Bob Corker and John McCain took to the Senate floor basically to get all emo about their hurt feelings and how they expected more of the president. And Bob Corker actually said his heart was pounding. I mean, he basically turned up their adrenaline, put them back in the spirit of the fight. Yeah. And I think that was an ill-judged decision.
Yeah. Sudeep, what do you think?
Washington melodrama. Look at that.
Yeah.
As
not
we get
surprised.
Closer to the fiscal cliff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To see lawmakers posturing about anything. If we really were that close to a deal, I don't think you would have seen President Obama come out there and take a risk of something like that. And so he probably knew there were Democrats who were quite upset at how the deal was shaping up and probably knew that he needed to make a point to them. And that was one of his goals, was to come out and show Democrats that this will affect middle class families. But
right.
what all they've done is deal with income taxes, which are one of the easier things to deal with in all of this. If you don't deal with the spending cuts part of this, which is why we're here, because the debt ceiling pushed a big spending cut issue to this point, then you don't really have a deal.
Well, give us a hint. What were some of the details on taxes that were leaking out that are substantive?
On one of them, if you actually push the threshold for whose income taxes you're going to raise up above $400,000, you're removing even more people from that pool of people who would be affected. And so it's very easy once you start excluding people from a tax increase to deal with that. And that's one of the issues that had been contentious, because Democrats know that if you wait a couple of days, you might be able to include more people in that.
Yeah. Heidi, any details leaking out that you were surprised at in regards to taxes?
None that were surprising, but a few that were actually sort of encouraging. One of them was that the alternative minimum tax, which is a way of limiting tax deductions so that you don't take so many so that you end up paying no tax at all,
right,
that that's going to be patched maybe forever under the deal that they were discussing. Mm-hmm. They were also talking about the estate tax, which is a big sticking point for Republicans when people die and they leave money to their heirs. How can that be taxed? It was originally going to be 55% if we go over the fiscal cliff, which we are, but now that's maybe down to 40 or 35%, which is a lot more reasonable. But I think all of that leaves aside the real issue with the fiscal cliff, which is not the middle class, but what's going to happen to the poor. A lot of people are going to be immediately homeless because they're going to lose, you know, subsidies and government assistance when we go over the cliff.
Yeah. Where do we go from here? I mean, what's going to happen in terms of the process? Doesn't look like anything's going to happen tonight, right?
Right. Exactly. The House is the idea was that the Senate would vote tonight and the House would vote tomorrow. Senate isn't voting tonight. And so that maybe means they're going to vote tomorrow, maybe next week. Who knows? I mean, it's all up in the air.
Now, what technically, though, happens at 12:01 a.m. tonight? Anything?
Very little actually happens tonight, and that's why it was almost a brilliant move to leak out some of these discussions and make it seem like they were very close to a deal, because
yeah,
it buys them a day and a half without having to worry about markets, so they can actually try to fill out some of the details on the rest of this. But if it's very clear already in any deal, the payroll tax holiday is expiring, and that actually expires today. And there's been very little discussion of this. Any politician who tells you that your taxes aren't going up is lying right now, because the payroll tax holiday goes away. Everybody's taxes go up at least by 2 percentage points for most families. And that's a very big deal that's going to weigh on everyone and weigh on the economy throughout 2013.
Right. Okay. So to be continued. Heidi Moore of The Guardian, Sudeep Reddy of The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Sarah.
Happy New Year, Sarah.
So these fiscal cliff negotiations have been a tough slog, which got us to wondering, how did Congress ever make big deals in the past? Used to be that political deal-making was all about horse trading, sometimes over pet projects in home districts, earmarks. Earmarks, though, have fallen out of favor in Washington. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer asks whether earmarks would have steered us away from the cliff earlier.
Used to be, if you wanted a member of Congress to vote for something, you tacked an earmark onto the bill. Funding for something like a new road in the member's district. Maybe you threw in a bridge. No more. Paul Light teaches government at NYU.
I just don't think there's an earmark big enough to offset the anger that gets produced by going home and saying, well, I voted for it, but I got you a bridge up on Highway 22.
Especially if it's a bridge to nowhere. Earmarks are practically poison now. Both parties agreed to ban them a few years ago. But earmarks are not only uncool, they're also inadequate, says Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution.
They're trivial considerations compared to the political forces that are driving the behavior of members now in this new partisan era.
Mann says members of Congress are afraid a controversial vote against the party line will result in a challenger in the next primary. He says party activists and big-pocketed super PACs are waiting to pounce on incumbents they perceive as disloyal. David Greenberg teaches political history at Rutgers University. He says in that kind of partisan environment, earmarks wouldn't get you much.
You're going to need some greater leverage than the kinds of small favors that have traditionally been used to pick up, you know, a handful of extra votes you need to get over the finish line.
And that helps explain why the fiscal cliff negotiations have been such a cliffhanger. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
More fiscal cliff a little later in the show. We are going over the cliff, but Wall Street was popping champagne. What's that about? Details when we do the numbers. In the world of professional football, this is not New Year's Eve. No, this is Black Monday. It's the day many an NFL coach gets the axe after a disappointing season. And today was no different. Andy Reid is out after 14 years coaching the Philadelphia Eagles. So is Lovie Smith of the Chicago Bears. The Chiefs, Chargers, Browns, Bills, and Cardinals all made changes at the top. So what happens when a coach moves from the sidelines to the unemployment line? Amy Scott reports.
In a press conference today, Philadelphia Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie said this is his least favorite day in the NFL.
Usually, for 14 years, I'm at home watching teams have to make changes with their head coaches. Today, we're in that position.
Ousted coach Andy Reid will fare okay. He's due to make $6 million next year, the last in his contract. Kenneth Shropshire directs the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. He says ex-head coaches often end up as defensive or offensive coordinators, or they go into television.
In some ways, it's a mad shuffle period where not so much the coach, but the coach's representative, lawyer, or agent is making out a plan, fielding a lot of calls, and trying to sort through things.
Some coaches who get the boot do go on to lead other teams. Today, the San Diego Chargers became the third team to fire head coach North Turner. It seems NFL coaches aren't that different from corporate CEOs. Bruce Sherman is a corporate succession consultant. He says fired CEOs often reemerge to lead other companies.
Most people who are at this level, they're not so good at sitting around.
Unlike corporations, Sherman says sports teams don't typically have succession plans in place and have to look outside for replacements. Even when they do plan ahead, it doesn't always work out. Tony Dungy of the Indianapolis Colts groomed his longtime assistant Jim Caldwell to take over. Caldwell was fired earlier this year after three seasons. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
How long does it take the government to clean up from a storm? Well, last year, Hurricane Irene devastated much of Vermont. And as Kirk Carapeza reports from Vermont Public Radio, FEMA still hasn't decided how to deal with properties damaged in that storm.
16 months. That's how long it's been since Irene ripped through the spine of the Green Mountains, isolating entire communities. Recovery's been slow. FEMA has given the green light for towns to buy out 81 homes in Vermont. But 16 months after the storm, no one has gotten any money yet.
I would have expected within a year, and that's gone by.
Bonnie Pemberton's home in Northfield, Vermont, qualifies for FEMA's Hazard Mitigation Program. It allows towns to turn property located in a floodplain into green space. The idea is to better prepare them for future flooding. Pemberton's home on Water Street sits in Northfield's floodplain, and it was destroyed in Irene's floods. But for her and her husband, FEMA's decision to approve their application has so far been a symbolic one.
We have not seen a penny. No, we haven't even seen the paperwork yet.
That delay is causing a lot of stress, and sometimes in the end you get a rejection, as 33 homeowners in Vermont did recently. Flood mitigation that may seem black and white, it turns out, is many shades of gray. FEMA spokesman David Mace says local officials should have been well aware that demolition of certain homes, even for health and safety precautions, disqualifies them for buyouts.
FEMA certainly doesn't like to play the role of the Grinch, but it's a benefit-cost analysis that has to be performed to determine that it is, in fact, in the federal government's best interest to purchase these homes and remove them from the floodplain.
As the late afternoon sky begins to fade to black, Bonnie Pemberton leaves work at National Life Insurance in Montpelier. She's returning once again to the home she and her husband have been renting for months from a doctor. A light snow falls, and Pemberton says she's worried about the heating bills they'll need to pay.
There was a lot more assistance last year to help us get through than there is this year.
The delay in funding has eroded Pemberton's hopes and expectations. Still, she's optimistic that they'll eventually get the money and that they'll have a new home by the time the leaves turn green in the spring. In Vermont, I'm Kirk Carapeza for Marketplace.
Coming up, saving the planet is good, right? So why are marketers so careful how they push green products?
It signals it's for a crunchy granola hippie or a rich elitist snob, not them.
But first, let's do the numbers. 2012 finishes on a high note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 166 points, 1.25% to close at 13,104. The Nasdaq gained 59 points, 2% to end at 3019. The S&P 500 ticked up 23 points, 1.75% to finish at 1426. For the year, the Dow climbed 7.3%. The S&P 500 added almost 13.5%, and the Nasdaq charged up nearly 16%. Overseas, France's CAC 40 gained 0.5%, Britain's FTSE and Germany's DAX each trudged down about 0.5%. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for November. The Louisville Cardinals and the Florida Gators face off in the 79th All-State Sugar Bowl in New Orleans. And on January 2nd, 1974, driving 55 became a federal law when President Nixon signed the Emergency Highway Energy Conservation Act. Thank God that's been repealed. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. 54-year-old steelworker Richard Crow is among the 2 million or so getting unemployment benefits right now. He lost his job 7 months ago and has been looking for another one ever since. That means he was watching the fiscal cliff talks very closely today. That's because without a deal, unemployment benefits are set to expire. Richard Crow, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So tell us, you've been unemployed for about 7 months now. What's that been like?
Not good. It's been a trying time for me and my family. And, you know, you're out there trying to find a job and get thank you for your interest. And for one reason or the other, you know, it's just got to keep on waiting and see.
You've been a steel worker for many years. Are you still looking for work in the steel industry, or are you trying to branch out?
I'm looking in the steel industry. I've applied for about 160 jobs in 7 months. And, you know, I've applied at jobs at, say, 10 o'clock in the morning, and 10:15, I get a thank you for your interest. You know, that tells me, you know, it's just my feelings. I can't prove it, but tells me they look at my age and they just move on.
So, Mr. Crow, what happens tomorrow if Congress doesn't come to some sort of a deal by midnight tonight? What happens to you tomorrow?
Well, I'll be out here with no job and no money coming in. I can probably survive for a couple of months, and that'd be about it.
Really? Then you start worrying about your house and about...
Mm-hmm.
What would you... If you could say something to Congress right now, and you can because you're on the air, what would you like to tell Congress?
I'd like to tell them to start getting together and doing things for the American people instead of everybody else in the world, instead of their own interests. Whether you like who the president is, whether you like it or not, you know, implement a plan down there one way or the other to benefit the American people. You know, and you know, that's what I like to tell them.
Any thoughts about getting retrained, or are you just going to look for, you know, perhaps settle for something? Are you willing to settle for something that doesn't pay as much?
And, well, if I have to, yeah. I need a job. I can't spend 2-3 years in school. You know what I mean? I need a job now.
Richard Crow in Wintersville, Ohio. Richard, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Unemployed steelworkers aren't the only ones affected by the fiscal cliff. Part of the talks is trying to avoid $110 billion in automatic spending cuts, so-called sequestration, set to hit midweek. The cuts are supposed to include more than $50 billion in defense spending, and that could affect everybody from defense contractors to Pentagon clerks. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Even if delayed by days or months, some cuts are likely to pinch at the Pentagon eventually. They won't affect uniformed military, so 1.4 million soldiers, sailors, pilots, and Marines remain on the payroll. If the Pentagon has to cut deep, it will furlough some of its 800,000 civilian workers. Press Officer Lieutenant Colonel Elizabeth Robbins.
Under Title 10, the Department of Defense needs to notify Congress
of any potential furloughs and to give them 45 days to process that.
The Pentagon also has to warn employees within 30 days. Neither notification has happened so far. Defense budget expert Gordon Adams at American University estimates 100,000 Pentagon workers might be furloughed, but full-scale layoffs aren't likely. The military would lose valuable expertise. Adams says businesses that provide services would be cut back.
Everything from mowing the lawn at Fort Belvoir to running a mess hall at Bagram Air Base.
Adams says military contractors are already getting used to less business.
Because the wars are ending, attention has shifted to the economy and the debt and the deficit. The Lockheed Martins and the Northrop Grummans have already been laying off people. They've already been closing production facilities.
Adams says even if the Pentagon doesn't take a 10% spending cut next year, figuring out how to deal with the fiscal cliff has been useful. It's taught top military brass they can and must make do with less. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Federal Trade Commission passed new rules this year to stop companies from saying that their products are good for the planet, if they're not. Thing is, though, most people don't seem to pay much attention to those claims anyway. Professionals in the branding and marketing world will tell you getting more consumers to go green is harder than you might think. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Ask people if they want to buy products that are better for the environment, and they pretty much all say yes.
I like the idea of being more conscious about buying products that use post-consumer waste.
It would probably be preferable if we found ways to increase how we recycle and what we recycle.
That's a video made by Cascades, the personal paper products company. In it, everyday people chime in on a new eco-friendly toilet paper. But ask them what's most important in a toilet paper.
Whether it's absorbent or not.
When you pull it off the roll, you don't want it to break.
I don't want John Wayne toilet paper.
Softness is a key.
Cascades had to consider those things first when it set out to make a new toilet paper that's unbleached, meaning not white. At first, they just tried skipping the bleach.
And the product came out really gray and dirty. It didn't look high-end at all.
Isabel Favre is a marketing director at Cascades. She says they added a light beige overtone.
So that's where we decided to introduce about 20% corrugated fiber.
Meaning 20% brown cardboard boxes. Yeah. VP of sales Dennis Lyon says the task seemed crazy.
We just never thought you'd be able to get the softness to the level that we did.
Cascades started by selling it to businesses only. Early adopters were companies eager to go green, think indie coffee shops and boutique hotels. Then college campuses caught on. A sample roll in the marketplace office elicited comments from, "Great, soft, I'd totally buy it," to, "Get that away from me." Cascades expects to roll out its beige toilet paper in stores next year. But getting people to use a product away from home when it's the only option is much different than getting them to choose it from a shelf of white, fluffy competitors.
People say one thing and do quite another thing.
That's Debbie Millman at Sterling Brands. She says in focus groups, people want to sound good. But at the store, especially on a budget, they go with products they know.
People do still want to be comfortable and they want something delicious and they want something that is going to make them feel good. They don't want to have a trade-off.
To get broad appeal, a green product has to work as well or even better than regular stuff and cost the same or less, and people have to get it.
We require a completely different approach when it comes to the mainstream.
Freya Williams is co-founder of Ogilvy Earth, a division of the ad company. She says about 15% of Americans are super greens. They care a lot about the planet and buy accordingly. Polar bears, tree frogs, burlap packaging totally works on them. But 66% of consumers she calls middle greens. If you get too earthy,
it signals it's for a crunchy granola hippie or a rich elitist snob, not them. We have to lose the crunch.
One way to do that? make green products about the future, she says. Tout hybrid cars, for example, as high tech, high performance. And don't mention a climate change apocalypse, because fear isn't the emotion you want to instill around, say, beer. And beer is what comes to mind for Williams when she sums up what green products need.
We need our Bud Light moment for sustainability marketing.
The goal is to make green normal, she says. Have the earth-friendly products blend in and add value on the shelf and in people's lives. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Author Philip Roth made a splash last week when he came out of retirement and started tweeting. No, wait, that was not Philip Roth. That was an imposter, somebody who apparently has a reputation for mimicking famous people on the internet. So what's that all about? Money? We asked Peter O'Dowd to figure out whether social media spoofs are profitable.
Remember Chuck Norris facts?
Chuck Norris discovered cold fusion by pouring two beers into one glass.
Ian Spector brought renewed fame to the action hero before Twitter was even born. Around 2005, his website caught fire, and since then, he's written five Chuck Norris fact books.
So it's really kind of taken on a really crazy life of its own.
Spector won't say how much money he's banked from it all. Not enough to live on, he says, but enough to get his young career in technology startups off the ground.
Orson Welles did it on the radio. Mel Brooks did it in movies.
Greg Gallant runs Sawhorse Media, a company that gives out awards to social media celebrities. He says Twitter parody is the latest frontier.
If it's successful, there's still a whole variety of outcomes where it can either be leveraged into a book or a successful comedy career.
Gallant says digital shenanigans make sense if you're trying to build a brand for yourself. But sometimes imposters are also malicious, thanks to a small tweak in a real person's name.
So it would spring out like Mari underscore Smith or Mari with two I's Smith.
Mari Smith is a social media consultant, 176,000 Twitter followers strong. She says an imposter tweeted on a variation of her name for 2 years before she was finally able to shut it down. The poser attacked her professionally and engaged with her clients.
I definitely was concerned. I had some serious concerns about the impact of my business.
Smith didn't bring a lawsuit, but she says imposters be warned, you're putting your own reputation on the line. In Phoenix, I'm the real Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, France is not falling off a fiscal cliff tonight, but it's having its own fight over taxing the rich. The high court there has rejected President François Hollande's 75% tax on millionaires. Hollande may redraft a watered-down version next year, but it may be too late to appease wealthy French citizens like actor Gerard Depardieu, who's moving to Belgium to escape French taxes. Even Hollande's advisors weren't totally behind it. One of them reportedly quipped that the 75% tax would turn France into, quote, Cuba without sunshine. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. 2012 finishes on a high note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 166 points, 1.25% to close at 13,104. The NASDAQ gained 59 points, 2% to end at 3019. The S&P ticked up 23 points, 1.75% to finish at 1426. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Sarah Gardner. We'll see you in the new year. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.